Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the Italian conglomerate that owns Beatrice Foods, Archway Cookies, and Parquet tumbles in what's being called the largest and most brazen corporate financial fraud in history.
Also, the case of the mad cow is prompting renewed calls for greater scrutiny of the nation's beef supply.
The threat is not enormous, but the disease is catastrophic.
And Discover Magazine's top science stories of the year. Number 5, the Bush administration.
The science community has been dissed to some extent by this administration, and it's having quite an impact.
These stories and the popularity of puppets coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Food and Drug Administration will ban the herbal supplement ephedra. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson says the ban will take effect in 60 days, but he gave this warning.
Today's actions tells consumers that the time to stop using these products is now. FDA will soon publish a regulation stating that dietary supplements containing ephedra present an unreasonable risk to the public health.
Congress took testimony this year from people who suffered ill effects from ephedra, as well as from relatives of people who died after taking the supplement. Northern California and Southern Oregon are recovering from a winter storm that closed a major north-south interstate highway. Tens of thousands of people were left in the dark. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Erica Kelly reports.
A 150-mile stretch of Interstate 5 is open again today between Redding, California and Ashland, Oregon, after the storm stranded thousands of motorists. More than 2 feet of snow shut down this main West Coast highway from late Sunday through Monday night. California Highway Patrol officials are warning that traffic could still move slowly throughout the day. The storm also left 4 feet of snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Pacific Gas and Electric reports that more than 200,000 of their customers lost power when wind, rain, and snow downed power lines. The National Weather Service says there will be a break in the weather today, but warns another storm is due to hit the area on New Year's Eve. For NPR News, I'm Erica Kelly in San Francisco.
Iraqi insurgents detonated a homemade bomb in a busy Baghdad neighborhood today. An Iraqi man was killed, but U.S. troops in a passing convoy escaped injury. From Baghdad, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The intended target in the hours as shopkeepers were beginning their day would appear to have been the U.S. troops who patrolled the streets of this popular shopping district in central Baghdad. Eyewitnesses said as the last vehicle in the four-car convoy passed, a loud explosion shook the area. A pool of blood in the muddy street marked the spot where an Iraqi man was killed, the latest civilian victim of the anti-U.S. insurgency. Windshields of the convoy were cracked. A soldier said an interpreter had been lightly injured. Shop windows were shattered, along with the nerves of local residents. The American patrols have made the Iraqi people targets, they complained. We want them to leave the city, one local man said, but added, not the entire country. That, he said, would be chaos. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Baghdad.
European mission controllers continue to search for the missing Beagle 2 Mars probe. It's believed to have landed on the Martian surface on Christmas Day, but none of its signals has been located. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 14 points at 10,435. The Nasdaq is down more than a point at 2,005. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, consumer confidence dropped this month after posting strong gains in October and November. The business research group, the Conference Board, says December's report dropped a little more than 1 point. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
While not a significant movement, the decline in consumer confidence this month still comes in somewhat sharp contrast to several recent upward movements in the index. The Conference Board reports its index fell from a revised 92.5 in November to 91.3 this month. The drop came as consumers remain somewhat concerned about current business conditions and about the job market. The index measures, among other things, whether jobs are viewed as abundant or hard to get. However, even with this month's dip, the index remains at relatively high levels. sales, and consumers' future expectations on the economy continue to improve. The percentage of consumers expecting business conditions to pick up over the next 6 months rose by nearly 3%, and the number of consumers expecting an improvement on the jobs front next year was also higher. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A Realtors trade group says sales of existing homes dropped in November. The National Association of Realtors report sales fell 4.6%. The group's chief economist says the huge sales pace could not be maintained from earlier this year. He adds, although sales of existing homes are lower, they're still at record levels. A fire at an Ohio metal recycling plant continues to burn. The blaze at the Garfield Alloys plant is fueled by magnesium, a substance that explodes when water is poured on it. Firefighters are letting it burn out. People living within a quarter mile of the plant have been evacuated. Firefighters have prevented the fire from spreading beyond the plant. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop offers compilations of music featured on NPR programming, including the new I Heard It on NPR box set at npr.org.
I'm Deborah Wong, in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's being called one of the largest and most brazen corporate frauds in history, and it widened to the United States this week. While the Parmalat Company is not exactly a household name here, some of its brand names are. Archway Cookies, Parquet, and Beatrice Foods are all under the Parmalat umbrella. Parmalat, the giant dairy and food company based in Italy, has acknowledged that it overstated its assets by as much as $4.9 billion. Its founder and former chairman is in an Italian jail. And yesterday in New York, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission accused Parmalat of trying to sell fraudulent bonds to U.S. investors. Fred Kapner is a correspondent with the Financial Times based in Italy. He's in New York today, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Fred.
Hello.
Well, like so many corporate scandals, this one is pretty complicated. So let's confirm some basic facts to start. On December 19th, the Parmalat company revealed that billions of dollars of assets on its books did not, in fact, exist. Now up to $12 billion is missing, correct?
That's correct. And it could be more.
And the company has been declared essentially bankrupt by an Italian court?
It's in bankruptcy protection as of this weekend.
Yeah. And company founder Callisto Tanzi is now in jail. It's suspected he personally pilfered about $999 million from the company, and he has apparently admitted to knowing about the fraudulent claims of the missing $12 billion, correct?
Pretty much. I mean, at this point, we don't exactly know what he's pilfered and what he's admitting. Some of the stuff comes out secondhand from the Italian court system.
Well, now on to the hard questions about what we do know. $12 billion is missing. Where did it go?
Yeah, most of the money was probably used to cover up losses over the past 12, 14 years. A lot of these losses were piled up by the family itself, which has invested its money in companies that were not connected to Parmalat. A lot of the money was also invested to make acquisitions that have gone bad.
Mm. This is being called Italy's Enron, but, you know, given the size, you know, relatively of the Italian economy, isn't it bigger than that?
I guess it could be considered bigger. Enron, on the other hand, was worth about $66 billion on the stock market, and now that's down to about $25 million, whereas Parmalat never ballooned out of proportion like Enron did, and it never was worth more than $3 billion.
Right. And as we understand, you know, a lot of the money was funny money anyway. So
yeah.
What is the company accused of trying to do in the States?
Well, the SEC is basically saying that even as Parmalat was facing bankruptcy, it was still trying to peddle some bonds, and that it had met with investors in the U.S. to that effect. And as a result, the SEC, which is trying to get a handle on the situation in the U.S., has filed a suit in New York District Court here.
Mm. Well, briefly, what is it about the Italian business environment and about Mr. Tanzi that made this all possible?
Well, it's not clear whether you can say it's just the Italian business environment. I mean, a year or two ago, obviously, all the Europeans were wagging the finger at the U.S. and saying that the U.S. was just as corrupt as every place else in the world. I would say that a lot of the things that we're finding here are things that we found, for example, with Enron. A lot of it is a problem regarding international finance. That is that companies become so large that they break off into little subsidiaries all over the world, and then big banks, Wall Street banks, Italian banks, whatever, work on parts of the company, and nobody bothers to control the whole.
Is it also true that Prime Minister Berlusconi, who's one of the country's leading business executives, has been accused by some of molding a business environment that favors, I don't know how else to say it, some form of criminal action?
Well, what he did was water down laws regarding fraudulent accounting. In the case of Parmalat, of course, it doesn't mean that people get off scot-free. But prosecutors are arguing and complaining that corporate executives have taken advantage of these watered-down laws to you know, skirt the law at the very least.
And briefly, Fred, what does this mean, if anything, to the American companies that Parmalat owns?
Most of them will probably have to be sold. There are businesses in Canada, businesses in the U.S., which are considered pretty valid, except that Parmalat overpaid for them over the last few years. So, but most people believe that the companies they do own here are good ongoing businesses.
Well, Fred, thank you.
You're welcome.
Fred Kapner, correspondent with the Financial Times, based in Italy, speaking to us from New York. U.S. agriculture officials say they will not immediately change the way the industry tests for mad cow disease, meat from so-called downer cows, cows that can't walk when they arrive at the slaughterhouse, will continue to be sold as long as there's no evidence of neurological problems. This after last week's discovery of mad cow disease in a so-called downer cow from Washington State. More on that in a moment. But first, we're asking, what are your thoughts about mad cow disease?
Can't feed a cow itself, not have something go wrong with it.
Are you scared about mad cow disease?
No, ma'am.
Are you still eating beef?
Yes, I am.
I mean, I haven't tried to stop eating beef, but yeah, I have. And I probably won't buy anymore for a while, just to see what happens, I guess.
Mad cow disease? I haven't thought anything about it.
No, I don't eat meat. The only meat I eat will be organic.
Am I nervous about mad cow disease? No.
Are you still going to eat beef?
Yes.
Thoughts about mad cow disease from some people we spoke with today.
The mad cow scare has renewed an old debate over the safety of the food supply. Consumer groups have long been pushing for much tighter scrutiny of beef destined for consumption. Carol Tucker Foreman heads the Food Policy Institute at the Consumer Federation of America. She was an assistant secretary of agriculture in the Carter administration and now serves as an advisor to both the FDA and the USDA. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, after the disease caused such a crisis in Great Britain, I think people here were under the impression that, there was a testing system in place to stop the same thing from happening here. Is that simply not the case?
That is simply not the case. We test about 20,000 animals a year. We slaughter 37 million head of cattle each year. There was never a system designed to prevent a diseased animal from getting into the food supply. The system was statistically set up to determine a reasonable level of certainty about whether the disease is present in the U.S. The problem is that USDA and the industry have operated with an unreasonable level of optimism that we would not have the disease rather than setting up a system that accepted the fact that there was a good possibility that it would occur here.
And there were warnings from your group, from scientists, from others, that the system, the testing system, should have been tightened up prior to this?
Yes, we have asked for additional testing. We've asked for, over a period of many years, a number of protections. For 25 years, we've been trying to get the government to institute a system to trace all animals back to the farm of origin. We have sought an end to the use of sick animals in the food supply.
So was it simply a question of the bureaucracy not paying enough attention, or was it a question of the industry arguing against your recommendations?
Both of those things. The cattlemen have argued that the things we're suggesting are too burdensome and too expensive, too intrusive and too expensive. USDA has said, well, our risk assessment shows that it is not necessary to do that. I just want to suggest to them that when they look back on the past week and they calculate the cost of having lost our foreign markets and having frightened American consumers, I think it will far surpass the cost of implementing more testing, trace back, stop using sick animals in the food supply, all of the things that we have suggested.
Well, now that there has been a cow testing positive for the disease, is there likely to be a change in the way that that the industry tests?
I wish I could answer that. I don't know whether the answer will be, yes, we need to do more, or if they will say, this was a Canadian cow, and we still don't have BSE in the U.S. They have always answered to our request by saying, but we don't have mad cow disease in the United States. Well, you know what? We do have mad cow disease.
But there have been those in the industry this week who have been saying, look, whatever happens, the threat from this disease is still absolutely minuscule.
I think that the threat is not enormous, but the disease is catastrophic. And you make decisions about how to react based on, in part, based on the frequency of the disease, and in part based on how serious it is. The variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease that seems to be related to BSE is catastrophic. You die if you get it, and it's a terrible death. I am very concerned that the industry is responding by saying, don't worry, be happy.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Carol Tucker Foreman is with the Consumer Federation of America. She served as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in the Carter administration. And this note, consumer advocates supported a measure before Congress this year that would have banned the sale of meat from so-called downer cows. The bill was aimed at preventing sick or injured animals from reaching the food supply. And if it had succeeded, it might have stopped the cow that tested positive for mad cow disease from being slaughtered. But the beef industry argued against the measure, saying it would impose an unnecessary hardship on the industry, and the House voted it down. Of those members who voted no, it turns out, a number were recipients of campaign contributions from the dairy and beef industries. Industry political action committees gave money to 33 members of the House Agriculture Committee. The chairman received the most. 28 of the members who received contributions voted against the ban on downer cows. The Agriculture Department estimates that 130,000 downer cows are slaughtered each year.
And finally, the price of beef fell again today, if not in the supermarket, then at least in trading on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. For the third straight day, the price of beef futures fell to the maximum amount allowed by the market. But while investors are nervous, other signs suggest that consumer demand has not been affected. Major hamburger chains are reporting that sales have not been hurt by news of mad cow disease.
And
And just ahead, Discover Magazine reviews the year in science in its latest issue.
And later in the program, a twice-convicted child killer is released from prison only to be accused of killing again.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
A couple of science stories have been dominating the headlines this week: the discovery of mad cow disease in the United States and the silence of the Mars probe Beagle. But what else was in the news in the world of science this past year? The latest issue of Discover Magazine reviews the top 100 science stories of 2003. Editor-in-Chief Stephen Petronic says the most compelling story by far was the breakup of the space shuttle Columbia.
I think that as tragic as the deaths of the astronauts are, I think what's more tragic is that it shows how broken an awful lot of what NASA is doing, especially with manned spaceflight, is wrongly thought out. I suspect that what Columbia really means is that the space station is kind of a joke.
You referred to the problems at NASA as a broken safety culture.
That's correct.
Any indication so far that this broken safety culture has been fixed in any way?
I don't think any of us can know for some period of time to come. I think they have, unfortunately, a need to get the shuttle back up in the air to service the space station. And I think that's going to drive things even more than safety does.
Now, number two on your list was the story of the age of the universe, 13.7 billion years old.
Yeah, this is more than just a nicely curious number. We've been, if you would read science publications for the last 4 or 5 years, you would find estimates all the way from 10 billion years to 20 billion years as the age of the universe. When you know exactly how old the universe is, you also know basically how long it is from one end to the other, and you know the shape and the structure of it. And that means that all the other science that involves galaxies and other planets and other solar systems and so forth suddenly has a very precise number to work with in its equations. So an awful lot of other science gets much more exact just by knowing these few simple basic things about the size, shape, and composition of the universe.
Now, number three on your list was the SARS outbreak, and your story focuses on a number of the lessons learned.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of lessons. I think the most important lesson, as far as someone who's living in the United States, is twofold. One, that the media could stir up concern to the level that people can approach a near panic situation. There was no reason whatsoever not to fly to Toronto because there were a few people in Toronto that had SARS. There was no reason to think that SARS was nearly as serious or as immediately fatal a disease because it wasn't. But on the other hand, it's striking that we have no national public health system, basically. That if we had an outbreak of SARS in some city and we had to do what the Chinese did and we had to isolate 10,000 people and keep them from sneaking out the back door to go to work, we have no way of dealing with the consequences of this. I just don't think we could physically do it in the United States.
Number four is a story about a motherless egg cell.
Correct. We took stem cells. Scientists took stem cells, which we now have discovered you can find in almost any part of the body. They don't have to come from a fetus or something like that. And they created a human egg. And that means that we don't have to go around harvesting any of this stuff anywhere. We don't have to go to fetuses, and we don't have to go inside women's bodies and give them all kinds of injections to produce lots of eggs so that we can take them out and study them and start messing around with them. We can do it from the get-go with stem cells.
All right, now number five is a story that might be a little bit surprising. It's a report critical of the Bush administration and its science policy. This is a report that didn't get much attention in the general public but created something of a firestorm among scientists.
You can go into any part of the scientific community, in academic, in governmental research, whether it's in the EPA or at the University of Michigan or someplace like that. Anywhere you go in the scientific community, you can start a rather excited conversation in a matter of seconds by talking about this particular administration and its view of science. There is no disagreement among scientists, for example, about global warming. I mean, you can't find one in 20,000 scientists who thinks that global warming isn't real. And yet, you go to the EPA, and all of a sudden you start getting these funny indications that, the science may not be good enough. You see things put up on their website that says, yes, global warming is real, and then you see them pulled down 3 months later. There's an awful lot of funny business in this administration, which is really not acknowledging that facts are facts and that science is science. And it's kind of the science community has been dissed to some extent by this administration, and it's having quite an impact.
Have you gotten a lot of response to this article?
Yes, we've gotten a lot of response, and a lot of it is surprising to us because a lot of our readers have written us and said, we'd rather you stay out of the politics and just report the facts.
Now, the last story on your list I thought was one of the most interesting ones. For those of us who can never find a comfortable pair of shoes, one researcher found that 5,000-year-old boot technology is actually superior to what we have today.
Well, if everyone remembers Otzi, as he's been named in posthumously, this was the Austrian fellow who was found in the Alps about 10 years ago. He was frozen 5,300 years ago. And one of the things that was preserved was his so-called shoes, which are basically sort of straw socks. And a group of scientists made five pairs of Otzi's boots and then put them on and went trekking up in the Alps. And they found that the socks or the shoes were rather amazing devices. They not only cushioned the foot as it walked, but they were warm and full of insulation because the hay that they're made out of is full of air holes.
So the next question is, where can we buy a pair?
Yeah. I think the lesson is to get a nice pair of hiking boots and stuff them with hay.
Okay. With that, thanks very much, Stephen.
It's a pleasure.
Discover Magazine Editor-in-Chief Stephen Petronic joined us from New York City.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a look back at the year in Iraq with journalist Anthony Shadid.
Also, we'll find out what it's like to be a Mormon missionary. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
You keep lying when you ought to be truthing.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a convicted child murderer released from prison, who is now charged with killing again, prompts calls for a national registry of murderers.
It's a great attempt to try to warn the public. The problem is the public usually does not use those warning signals.
Also, the surge of popularity in puppet theater.
Some of the most interesting theater I've seen recently, frankly, has been puppet theater. Part of it, I think, being that puppets can sometimes do things or say things that, you know, maybe other mainstream theater companies are afraid to do or to say. Also, it allows for an element of fantasy and surrealism.
Those stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The Bush administration today banned the dietary supplement ephedra because of growing concerns about its effects on health. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson says the FDA is warning manufacturers to stop selling the product.
FDA is issuing a consumer alert on these products, warning everyone of the dangers that they pose. FDA is sending letters to 62 manufacturers telling them as soon as our rule takes effect, they must stop selling these ephedra products.
Ephedra is linked to heart attacks, strokes, and deaths in healthy people. Manufacturers are expected to fight the ban. There's word of an Israeli helicopter strike on a car in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian witnesses say the helicopter fired two missiles at a car in a neighborhood that is a stronghold of the militant group Hamas. There's no word yet on any casualties. Efforts in earthquake-ravaged Iran have gone from search and rescue to humanitarian relief. Officials now say the death toll from Friday's quake could number more than 40,000. Thousands have already been buried in a mass grave. Meanwhile, new aid continues to arrive, including an American military plane carrying 80 personnel and medical supplies that landed today. Seven U.S. Air Force C-130 cargo planes had already been sent to the earthquake zone. Rana Sadani of the International Red Cross says survivors of the earthquake have immense emotional and physical needs.
They are traumatized, very sad, very angry, and in the same time, you know, they have needs. They have basic assistance, basic needs such as they need shelter, they need food, they need water.
Today, six Gulf states pledged $400 million to help reconstruct Bam, best known as the site of the world's largest medieval mud fortress, a 2,000-year-old citadel that crumbled in the quake. Iranian President Mohammad Khatami today vowed to rebuild Bam within 2 years. Khatami also thanked anybody who's offered assistance, including the Americans, but he downplayed talk that Washington's contribution would thaw the frosty relations between the two nations. The Census Bureau says the U.S. population grows by one person every 12 seconds. The Bureau today reported that the U.S. population on January 1st will be just over 292 million. That's up 1% over last year. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
What happens to a convicted murderer after he goes to prison? Many people assume he stays there for life. And if he does get out, he'll be tracked, right? wrong. Residents of Indiana are coming to grips with the fact that a twice-convicted child killer from Illinois was released from prison for good behavior, spent 3 years on parole, and then allegedly murdered a third, fourth, and fifth time. The bodies of three teenagers were discovered in his basement. Now Indiana and Illinois are considering a registry of murderers. Joining us on the line from Chicago is freelance reporter Eric Furkenhoff. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
Tell us about this case. The name of the killer is David Edward Maust.
David Edward Maust. He has just a very strange history, which he actually wrote about in an 87-page diary, which maps out a very violent and troubled past.
In which he also says, this was when the second time he was in prison, he says, he said at the time he wanted to get the death penalty so he wouldn't hurt again, but he was released.
Right. But his history goes back as far as 1974, when he was a private in the U.S. Army stationed in Germany. And at that time, he killed a 13-year-old boy and spent time incarcerated in Germany, then was sent to Leavenworth in Kansas and spent time in federal prison there.
And then in 1981, he murdered again a 15-year-old.
Named Donald Jones. And police had caught up with him and had him under surveillance, but he fled to Texas. And then while in Texas, again in the early 80s, he stabbed another boy, this one he just injured, and was actually convicted and incarcerated on that charge. When investigators from the Chicago area went down and got a confession from him in the 1981 murder, he was then extradited to Illinois, and he was in and out of mental institutions over the next 12 years and didn't actually plead guilty to the murder until 1994. However, he was given time for the 12 years that he was in prison, and under Illinois law at the time, you were given a day's time for a day served for good behavior. And while he was sentenced to 35 years in prison for the murder of Donald Jones, he only had to serve 17 and a half years and was out in 1999.
Right. And as we said, spent 3 years on parole and then is now accused of murdering three teenagers found buried under the basement of the home that he was living in. Putting aside the questions people have about how a convicted killer, a twice-convicted killer, who also attempted murder, as you said, and now has been accused of killing again, how he possibly could have gotten out of prison so many times. The fact is he was released from prison legally. Now, the question is, Illinois is now looking at having a murderer's registry. How would that work?
Well, actually, Illinois and Indiana are both considering it. And in Indiana, there's actually two legislators who have proposed an amendment to the sex offender registry. And how that would work is they would simply change the law that set up the sex offender registry to include murderers. In Illinois, there's also discussions going on, but they're not at the point where any legislation has been proposed, but they're trying to figure out ways of how they could do it, perhaps including all child murderers in some sort of a registry, or perhaps all murderers.
Mm. As you know, there are those who say, well, but is this really necessary? Because murderers, despite Maust's example, they really don't recidivate. You actually give some statistics that in the year 2000, there were 308 inmates paroled on murder from Illinois. Only 93 were sent back to prison, and of those, only 10 committed another murder. But
correct.
some would say only 10.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's kind of a tricky number. I mean, can you really say only 10? I mean, there's 10 victims. But it's not like sex offenders. Sex offenders, the recidivism rate is obviously quite higher, and that has always been sort of the foundation for coming up with sex offender registries. Some criminologists would argue that it's not necessary when it comes to murders because they don't repeat their crimes very often. But obviously you're going to have some victim advocates that would say, well, one is obviously too many. The crimes that they've committed is quite violent. These people need to be watched.
And in fact, we're going to speak to one such advocate in just a moment. But Eric, what are people saying in Illinois and in Indiana?
Almost every single person was just baffled. How could this person possibly be living in our neighborhood or in our community without us knowing?
Well, Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eric Furkenhoff, freelance reporter in Chicago, Illinois. We now turn to Nancy Rui, executive director of National Parents of Murdered Children, a survivors advocacy group based in Cincinnati, Ohio. Nancy, your reaction to the thought of a registry for murderers?
Well, I guess it's kind of twofold. One, I think it's a great attempt to try to warn the public The problem is the public usually does not use those warning signals. They don't log on to see about sex offenders. They're less likely to log on to see about murderers.
I'm wondering, with 308 inmates paroled in Illinois alone, I can't imagine how many there are nationwide, and it's hard to find out because people don't keep track of these numbers. But is the system even big enough to follow thousands of convicted murderers as they go on to their new lives?
They should be big enough to follow. They should be responsible for society and society's safety. I mean, that's what we have parole boards for. That's what we have laws for, to protect people in society. And if they're not big enough now, they should spend the money to be big enough. We have something on our little organization of 100,000 members that's called Killer Alert. When a killer gets out of jail, out of serving his time, his face, his name, everything is put on our website, and we let you know in what state he's living, what city, and as close as we can come to his address.
And, of course, to people who say, well, that violates his right to privacy, you say?
I say he violated his right to privacy when he took another person's life.
Yeah. Before we let you go, I just want to ask you, I'd had the opportunity to interview the founder of your organization back in the early 80s when it was an unthinkable group, Parents of Murdered Children. Now, of course, as you said, it's got a huge membership. At that time, her daughter had been murdered by her college boyfriend. What happened to him?
He served time. It was in Germany. She was an exchange student. He served 13 months in Germany, was released back to the United States without a record, went on to get married, settle down, left his wife in the 90s, moved to Miami, Florida. His name is Bill Coday. He met a young woman. He started dating her. She tried to break off the relationship, just like 18-year-old Lisa had done, the Hollinger's daughter. When he could not stand the rejection, he called her to his home to see him one last time, and he beat her to death the same way he did Lisa Hollinger. He is now on death row in Miami, Florida, for that crime.
20 years later, could a registry have followed him for 20 years and prevented that second murder?
Registry could have followed him for 20 years. Would the young woman he murdered have known he was a previous murderer? I doubt it. Would she have looked on the registry to see who she was dating? I doubt it. I don't think it would have prevented the murder. I think we have to do is educate the public that murderers are released. They're walking out of prisons every day. They're living next door to you. And just like sex offenders, it's our responsibility to take action and to find out who's in our neighborhoods. Who's watching our kids? Who's teaching our kids? You know, who's babysitting for us? That's our responsibility, and we need to take that action.
Nancy, thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Rui, Executive Director of National Parents of Murdered Children. She spoke to us from Cincinnati.
You're listening to Here and Now. Consumers spent a little bit more this Christmas than last. MasterCard says total sales over the Christmas period were up 6.5%. Analysts say a buying surge late in the season helped boost sales figures. With the economy still struggling, though, how have Americans been spending money this year? To get a sense of the country's collective mood, USA Today recently looked through the giant databases of eBay, the online marketplace, to find out what its 86 million members were buying and selling. The newspaper's technology columnist, Kevin Maney, joins us on the line. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Well, for your story, you looked at the most popular items that people were searching for on eBay over the course of the year. So what did you find?
It was really interesting to follow the top 10 or 20 word searches through the year, because at the beginning of 2003, there were all these searches for like things like Gucci and Prada and BMW, you know, luxury goods, essentially. And all of a sudden, about August, there was this dramatic shift away from those kinds of things to much more mundane things, like just the color pink or Ford instead of BMW. And in fact, even in September, the word salvage came up to the top 10.
What does that seem to mean?
Well, you know, we try to take what was there from the eBay numbers and sort of look at it in comparison to the news and economic numbers and things that were going on. And the only conclusion we could come to is that the problems of the year, of the Iraqi war, of the blackouts and SARS and all these kinds of things that went on, coupled with the persistent joblessness that has been plaguing the economy despite any kind of turnaround over the past year, and just came to the conclusion that I guess people started to just seem worn out.
Which seems to fly in the face of the conventional wisdom that says that the economy was actually beginning to recover at the end of the year.
Well, the thing that's about that is that the economy did recover over the year when you look at the stock market and you look at things like numbers like productivity and company earnings and things like that. But the job numbers did not pick up. So when you look at something like eBay, which is really about individuals' lives and what they want and what they're doing, I think it reflects that that recovery is not yet really happening.
Just about every big news story of the year seemed to have prompted a surge in hits on eBay.
One of the ones that I liked was the sale of generators. So there was in August, there was the big blackout in the Northeast. And all of a sudden, there was this fairly, probably predictable spike in searches and sales of power generators. But what ended up being interesting is that it didn't fall off. It wasn't this sort of knee-jerk response. And in fact, we talked around to people and got some ideas that maybe that suggests that we don't have a whole lot of faith in our electric power system anymore after that happened, and we want to be ready for the next blackout.
And in your research, what was the strangest thing that you found someone tried to sell on eBay?
There was one person who tried to sell Paul McCartney's germs from a Kleenex that he apparently used. And there was a number of things that eBay actually disallowed over the year. I mean, for instance, people were trying to sell fragments from the Saddam Hussein statue that was toppled in Baghdad, and eBay has a policy of not allowing people to profit from disasters, so they pulled that off. I don't know if you recall when that Chicago Cubs fan got in the way of a foul pop fly
across
the Cubs that particular game. There were people who were trying to sell personal contact information for that poor guy on eBay, and again, eBay got in the middle of that and pulled it off the site.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Deborah. It was a pleasure.
Kevin Maney is a technology columnist for USA Today.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows and what's on the other side?
Kermit the Frog, performing in his first full-length motion picture, 1979's The Muppet Movie. For many adults, this was their first love affair as adults with puppets, leading the rest of the world to ask, "What took you so long?" Puppetry for adults has always been popular around the world, and now it's catching on here in the States. Puppets are hot on Broadway, late-night TV, and in theaters around the country. Well, joining us in the studio to talk about the surge in popularity of puppetry is Here Now theater critic Bill Marks. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Karen Larson, artistic director of the Puppet Showplace Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
And Bill, to you first. Jim Henson, he set such a standard for puppetry here in the U.S., but it seems as if the U.S. really lags behind the rest of the world in respecting puppets.
Well, that's because puppets are generally seen as being for kids. A lot of people grew up watching puppets on television, and they were associated with often bad cartoon shows, or in other cases, maybe saw them in live marionette shows. So the idea is that puppetry really has a long tradition, and it's often been for adults as much as for
for kids. So, you know, what we're seeing now essentially is that we are catching up with the rest of the world in terms of seeing puppetry and respecting it.
Karen, you're well aware of this, the fact that I'm thinking of the television shows in Britain and Canada that use puppets for political satire. Mm-hmm. It's used in many different ways around the world.
Well, of course, and it's always been a political form. I mean, Punch and Judy was really a political form. I think in this country, because puppetry was so popularized on television, people sort of got used to it as this children's art form. And because of that, it became sort of economically unviable for puppeteers to create puppetry for adults when very few people were coming to it. I think that between the work that Jim Henson did with making puppetry exciting for children and adults at the same time, and also some of the work that a lot of people probably don't know about with him bringing a number of extraordinary companies from around the world to New York, a major thing happened. And that was that the media started paying a lot of attention to adult puppetry. So all of a sudden you were having reviews of puppetry in the New York Times and in Time and Newsweek. And it made it so puppeteers had a little more faith that they might be able to make a living at it. So now more puppeteers are creating shows for adults.
One longstanding troupe, for example, is Bread and Puppet Theater, which is situated up in Vermont. And for the last four decades, they've been doing a political theater using often giant papier-mâché heads or figures of the current powers that be, and using the sort of grotesque, sometimes quite beautiful puppets, you know, to satirize what was going on politically. Here's some sound from the Bread and Puppet program that I saw, mainly some of the music, because they go with a live band, and there's a lot of songs and singing going on in all their shows.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the circus!
Some of the most interesting theater I've seen recently, frankly, has been puppet theater. Part of it, I think, being that puppets can sometimes do things or say things that, you know, maybe other mainstream theater companies are afraid to do or to say, because it's not like a human being saying some subversive political thing or making fun of, you know, the powers that be, but a puppet. There's, you know, in other words, the identity of the perpetrator is disguised by the fact that there's this sort of weird-looking figure saying what could be some fairly challenging words. Also, it allows for an element of fantasy and surrealism.
And they can also be an African animal when you can't actually bring one on the stage. I'm thinking of Julie Taymor and what she did with Lion King.
Which is stunningly beautiful art, but also very powerful messages in that show.
Well, there's now a new Broadway show, Avenue Q, which had an off-Broadway run earlier this year, now, of course, is super hot on Broadway. It combines puppets with real actors in the cast.
Everyone's a little bit unsatisfied.
Everyone goes round a little empty inside.
Take a breath, look around,
swallow your pride.
For now.
Well, I think it's interesting that most people in America seem to think of a puppet show as something that happens behind a booth with the puppeteer invisible. But more than 50% of the shows we do have both puppets and actors on stage.
Yes, but do you do them underwater? I'm thinking some of the best puppetry I've ever seen is in Vietnam. The water theater puppets.
They actually, within the past, year or 2 years, visited here.
Just last June, World Music brought them.
And they were really quite wonderful to see and exciting. And that's a show that I think also appeals to kids and to adults as well. I mean, the puppets are beautiful. The stories are interesting and exotic. And I do think that there's this sort of identity crisis that as adult puppetry grows and becomes larger in popularity, it's going to have to put its foot in one side or the other. It's either going to be for adults or it's going to be for kids. And maybe it'll be for adults and maybe older kids may be able to get into it. But I don't think you can always straddle both audiences.
And then there is the really immature puppetry for adults, which I'm referring, of course, to Triumph, you know, that sort of raunchy hand rag from Late Night with Conan O'Brien. They can be silly, they can be gross. In Triumph's case, in fact, we have a little bit of Triumph from Conan O'Brien.
Hey, what's going on here? This new carpet is soaked. Now tell me you just spilled water on it.
Well, it used to be water 4 hours ago.
I cannot believe that you did that.
Hey, easy, Fifi. We're roommates. I'm marking my territory.
Yeah. Well, no wonder your wife threw you out.
Hey, she'll be back. Wait till she's in heat.
So this is a whole other genre of puppetry that's just really been going gangbusters. They're sort of the raunchy, immature sock puppet. But either way, it reflects something that something's obviously happening.
Well, people find it memorable. You know, you remember those characters, whether you like them or not. Sometimes you remember things you don't like as much as things that you do like. But we sort of like those puppets because they're an entree. People see that. They think, oh, I like that. It's a way of bringing people into the form who might not normally have been brought into the form.
I don't completely disagree. Just that in this country, let's use Triumph, the insult dog, as a good example. I mean, the dog might whet the appetite of people to go and see puppets, or they'll go to see puppets and go, why aren't they saying stupid, silly things? In other words, it seems to me that you have to try to elevate people's idea of the art of puppetry. And to me, that means when you have adults come, you have to give them the idea that it is going to be something mature and sophisticated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Perhaps in the long run, you will be able to fuse or merge together more sophisticated kids with adults. But as far as I'm concerned, we just have to elevate people's image mm-hmm. of what puppetry is in this country at the moment. Mm-hmm. Triumph, the insult dog, isn't really doing puppet. I don't think it's particularly doing puppetry any good, just making it look sort of stupid.
I just want to ask you, Karen, just give us a couple of storylines, if you could, of some of the themes that you might tackle, or what, you know, give me a one-line synopsis of some of the puppet plays that someone might see at the Puppet Show Place.
Last year, we opened with One Way Street by Sandglass Theater. Sandglass Theater is a company that worked for years in Europe primarily because there wasn't an audience here, and finally said, if we want an audience here, we have to be the ones who help build it. And so they've opened their own theater in Putney, Vermont, and they both, in fact, right this very second, they're in Europe touring again because there still is not enough work in this country for mm-hmm. them to make a complete living here. But they run a beautiful theater where they're exposing fairly rural Vermont audiences to the same kind of sophisticated work that I'm exposing audiences in the Boston area to, and they're doing it very successfully.
In One Way Street, the show was one of my favorite shows that I saw last year, and it dealt with Walter Benjamin, the Jewish literary critic and philosopher. I mean, a puppet show about dealing with heavy-duty issues of Jewish thought, the Nazis, the Holocaust, and so forth. And it was done quite beautifully with a sort of mischievous intellectual playfulness.
Every image of the past, which is not recognized by the present as one of our own concerns, threatens to disappear.
Well, I want to thank you both.
It's a pleasure to talk about puppets.
Thanks so much for having me.
Karen Larson, artist director of the Puppet Showplace Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts, and, of course, our Here and Now theater critic, Bill Marks. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Jordana Gustafson, Rachel Dornhelm, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis.
Also, Andrea Shea, Sarah Cook, Brad Fritz, and Ann Stevenson. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Trapatsky. Our web producer, Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
We'll take a look back at the year in Iraq with journalist Anthony Shadid.
Also, we'll find out what it's like to be a Mormon missionary.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.